It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. With winter rapidly approaching, many city dwellers are thinking about hunkering down and staying close to home with forays to Kincaid Park or Girdwood on the snow. But winter is the best time to visit some of Alaska's most beautiful spots, and our public use cabins make it easy, with a hard roof and a stove to keep you warm and a dry bunk to put you down in your sleeping bag. Planning a winter trip requires some additional thought, and the cold adds to the challenge, but the glory of Alaska in winter is well worth it, and the sense of camaraderie with friends in the backcountry for a weekend in the snow is its own reward. So that's our topic today. We're going to be talking about planning a wintertime cabin trip. So many options to do it around Anchorage and all over South Central Alaska, and even up to Fairbanks and Southeast. Anywhere you might want to do an expedition, almost you can find a cabin there. And I've got two guests who are quite experienced at doing this in the studio with me. Michael Henrich is a board member with the Alaska Huts Association. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Thank you, Charles.
And Paul Twardock is almost a regular on the show. He's the chairman of the APU Outdoor Studies Department. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Great to be here again.
So I thought we would just talk with people who have not considered doing an overnight trip in the wintertime. I guess it may sound totally intimidating, but it really isn't. Maybe we start out talking about what's great about it. I actually just came back from my cabin. I mean, fall is a little bit like winter, and the stars were unbelievable. I saw the Northern Lights. I mean, it looked like the Milky Way was so bright you could almost reach out and touch it. And, you know, because in the summertime we don't get that much darkness. Now it's getting really, you know, this totally inky dark, and the stars just jump out at you. And that's really true on your when you go out into a wintertime trip to any cabin, is they get this beautiful darkness at night. And Paul, do you have some particular memories of places you've been in the wintertime at the public use cabins that are really special to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many. And I think the stars, the quiet, I think is something that really strikes me as a very great aspect of winter. And there's life out there. The other thing that I love about being out in the winter is tracks and tracking. You sort of might not see a lot, but they're there. You see the snowshoe hare tracks, the lynx, occasional wolf, coyotes. So that whole scene, the winter ecology part of it, I really dig a lot. And just sort of the idea of being someplace that, you know, most people aren't going to go at that time of year. That's the kind of stuff I really enjoy.
Yeah, and you really got it yourself in that people will do a day skiing thing and you can only go so far. And then they'll be back to make sure they get back to the car by sunset, which could be 3 o'clock, right? Yep. But you get to stay out there. And so the wilderness is all to yourself.
Yeah, and the idea of, I've always been, the idea of the challenge and the effort to make something happen, to get to a place, sort of adds to the quality of the experience. Like, I feel like I've accomplished something when I've gotten there, and it's such a great feeling that, you know, winter is challenging. I mean, it's not, you know, for the faint of heart. I mean, like I said, it's well within most people's capabilities, but you have to plan for it. You have to have the right equipment. You have to have food and water and think it through, maybe know a bit about wilderness travel. And all that effort, then you get there, and especially with these cabins, there's a little bit of a, you know, safety net there mm-hmm. going on that make it very rewarding to go to these places.
Yeah, and you got to get this little house on the prairie feeling where, you know, if you take your kids, they're going to have a whole new feeling when they, you know, they've hauled their stuff in on a sled, they've set up sort of housekeeping in the cabin, get it warm, and the cold, inky darkness is outside, and then the whole family's in there in this cozy, warm spot with the lantern, you know. It's really something that folks from other places in the country are never going to experience. It's really uniquely Alaskan.
Yeah, it is a very neat thing. And there's so many opportunities. I mean, there are so many cabins out there and so many great places to go explore. And when you're at a cabin then, I mean, there's trips you can do. You can link up routes, or you can just go to a place and hang out and get to know that place very well.
Yeah. So, Michael Henrich, I know that the Alaska Huts Association has set up this Manitoba Hut, but you've done a lot of cabin trips over the years. What are some of your favorite memories?
I'm like Paul. I really appreciate the quiet, getting out there, and the effort it takes. And at night, when you have the wood burning stove burning away, crackling away, and the cabin's nice and toasty, and you walk outside and check out the stars, and just feel so nice and crisp. And of course, you don't have to worry about mosquitoes and bears, which some people, of course, are worried about. Mm-hmm. But it is a little bit more effort to do that in the wintertime, too. You have to haul in your own wood for the fireplace. And, of course, gear. You have to bring more warm gear, maybe a warmer sleeping bag. But there's been so many nights out there when the northern lights would just be dancing up above you and not a sound around. And you really don't see any other people a lot of times, too. So
This whole thing about the night sky is something that is easy to forget when you spend a lot of time in Anchorage, but you really don't see much of the night sky in Anchorage. You've got to get pretty far out of town before the sky's dark enough to see much of anything.
Yeah, it almost feels like you can just reach out and touch the stars. Mm-hmm. They're so bright and crisp. And the moon, like that moon you've had the last couple nights, that would have been something to be out at one of the cabins and seeing that as well.
Well, then you can ski in the moonlight. People think that, well, when the sun goes down, you got to sort of hunker down inside. But if you've got a big full moon, you're really still operative.
There's no need for lights, not even headlamps. I don't even take headlamps.
Mm-hmm. Because the snow will reflect all that light back up. It's interesting, you know, when you're skiing in Anchorage in the winter, there's so much light from the parking lots and the streetlights and stuff that if it's cloudy, you can ski at night, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's clear and there's a big moon, you can ski at night. If it's clear and there's no moon, then you need a headlamp, right? So, I mean, I'm a lover of winter, and when I hear people say, oh, no, there's termination dust, I'm more of the mind, like, what's fall good for, right? Get this over with, get the snow here, and let's start having some fun.
Yeah, and the cabins are much easier to reserve in the wintertime, too. Mm-hmm. They're not near as popular as in the summers, so that's kind of a nice thing to have, too.
Well, let's start talking about some of the options. And let's start with listeners who might have never done this before. Maybe they have kids. Maybe they don't feel like they could go a huge distance. You don't have to go that far into the woods to get to a cabin, and you then your safety net, the sort of car with its warm heater, is maybe only a couple of miles away, and then you can use that as a base. And if you've got kids, they can sort of play in the wilderness and have that experience without going a huge distance. What are some of the options for that? Do you want to take that one first, Michael?
Yeah, I think a good one, and what I start off with, is the Nancy Lake system. Mm-hmm. There's four cabins right on Nancy Lake that only require probably like a quarter mile to half mile hike in. And in the wintertime, you can ski or snowshoe. And it's really easy to pull wood in your sled that way. You can make numerous trips back and forth even, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in my mind, there's also a Bald Lake cabin that's right there. And Byers Lake is just right up the road that you can pretty much drive to. So that makes it fairly easy, and your car's right there if there is some type of problem.
Right. These are all state parks cabins, and they are around canoeing. They're essentially built for canoe routes, and so for the most part, it's going to be quite flat, and you're not going to get lost unless it's like freshly, you know, you have fresh snow or something. But you can always find a lake and find your way.
The trails are pretty well marked, mm-hmm. and you can get maps before you go, which is always a good idea. I think.
I did a great trip up there on the Nancy Lake system before it snowed, but after we had ice, and it was a cabin-to-cabin skating trip and
nice.
With younger kids, and I pulled a kid in a sled, and we just had a fantastic time. Lots of skating, really beautiful. Sort of backcountry skating is so gorgeous. You know, you get to see the stuff you never see, like the ice roses on the lakes and weird sounds that the lakes make. We did make one little mistake on that, and that we like looked at each other when we got to the cabin, like, who has the saw, right? So this is where I'll get into this, like what not to forget. So we had one kind of chilly night on that trip, but Paul, what are some of your suggestions for first time or close to the road cabin?
Yeah, I think there's some great ones right around Anchorage. The Eagle River Visitor Center mm-hmm. has their yurts, and they have, I think, a cabin that's very close to the visitor center right there. There's on the Klutna Lake, there's the Uditna cabin, which is about 3 miles in on the Lakeside Trail, which is very accessible.
That's state parks?
The state parks. Mm-hmm. Also, the state parks just opened up the remodeled Indian campground down on Turlington Arm, and they have two cabins there. I'm not 100% sure whether they're going to be open in the winter, but I believe they are, and they're also more or less drive up to them.
Is that the sort of the Bird Creek campground?
Yeah, Bird Creek, sorry. Bird Creek, which
was like remodeled, I mean, like big time.
Big time, yeah. Yeah, they had issues with beetle killing there and old trees, so they went in and basically remodeled it and put a couple nice cabins. One, which is quite large, it can sleep like 15 people. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ones that come to my mind. Michael mentioned Byers Lake, but all ones. Now, those ones that are close to the trails are very popular and tend to be a little harder to, mm-hmm. to book.
But they can be done very easily as a weekend from town.
Oh, yeah.
You can, you know, Saturday morning get up and in sunrise and be in the cabin like, you know, an hour later from the trailhead, essentially. And then you've got a weekend out there that's pretty special.
And some of these are all pretty much drive up. Mm-hmm. So you can drive up. It might be a short walk. But those are all excellent for first time. Because, you know, if you get in there and it's not for you or you forgot something, the car's not that far away to retreat to.
Right. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking today about public use cabins in the wintertime. There are public use cabins in other parts of the country, but Alaska is pretty much the national center for public use cabins. We've got so many of them with the National Forest, Tugatch and Tongass National Forest. The state parks have a number of cabins. The national park has a few cabins. There are also some BLM cabins. Mm-hmm. And then there are some private cabins that are like the Mountaineering Club and the Alaska Hut Association cabin. If you want to find out how to reserve cabins, go to alaskapublic.org, take a look at today's show, Winter Cabins, and you'll find links to each of these organizations. And for the most part, you can just reserve online and, you know, put in your credit card, and then you've got a reservation for the cabin. How does that work, Paul? Because it seems like if you're reserving a hotel room, there's somebody there, and you arrive and you say, I have a hotel room reserved. But with the cabins, you reserve, you pay, and all that really means is that nobody else is supposed to be there.
Right. So they'll you'll get a receipt, a permit, actually, that you'll need to print off, and you'll have to have that with you. And, you know, multiple times I've showed up a cabin, and for one reason or another, someone else is there. Mm-hmm. And I heard a story the other night when I was talking about this show with friends. They're like, oh, yeah, we showed up a cabin, and these people, they had their permit, we had their permit, and we all got our permits out, and their permit was for May, not for March. And these poor people had done all this work to get in there, their, you know, all their food, and they had their snow machines and everything. And so it all worked out. People tend to be super friendly with these things. But if you don't have your permit, and you do show up at a cabin, unless it's an emergency, you have to respect the people who have paid and reserved for it.
And in fact, I don't think it's right to use a cabin without paying. You know, you can show up, maybe there's nobody there, but the fact that the system exists is partly because people pay.
Yeah.
And also you run quite a risk. I remember being out in the Sound and coming to a cabin on a really stormy, nasty night. And there's a bunch of guys in our cabin, and they sort of said, well, our time is up, but we didn't want to leave. And I was like, okay, we've got kids. You're out of here.
Yeah.
They were nice about it. They left, but then they were going off into the – I mean, if you do stay in a situation like that, there's a good chance that you're going to have to leave, and you're going to be going out into bad weather. So it's better not to do that.
Right, yeah. If you don't have a really, really good reason, an emergency of some sort, and you don't have a permit, you shouldn't be staying in the cabins. And that's just, you know, it's just respect for other users.
Right. And you need to reserve for, as we were saying, for the really easy to get to cabins on the weekends. Probably they're booking up through the winter now, right, Michael?
Yeah, I'd say so. I looked at the Nancy Lake just the other day, and it's into February now, that, you know, especially the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you want to get on it right now if you want to get some of the key. March is a really popular month because, you know, that obviously is one of the more beautiful months up here.
Yeah.
So, you know, January, a little bit easier because people don't necessarily want to get out when, you know, in the middle of winter like that.
Because it's dark and it's colder. Yeah. And if you can go during the week, you pretty much have your choice. You can, for the most part, go with not too much advance notice.
Pretty much, yeah. During the week is the time to go if you can, except for maybe spring break.
Mm-hmm, right.
Spring break, Thanksgiving is another busy time for them. If you want to do something over Thanksgiving, and want to get on and get those cabins reserved.
Tell me about the hut, the Manitoba hut, in terms of you're a bit different because it's not a private cabin you share.
Yeah, and we're definitely we're a nonprofit, and what we have is two separate yurts that you stay in. Each yurt will sleep eight, and then we also have the cabin that we it's an old miner's cabin that we remodeled. And basically, you go and spend your cook your meals and spend your time in the cabin, and you sleep in the yurts. And the cabin has propane stove, propane lights, all the utensils you might need, and basically all you have to do is bring your food and your bedding for the yurts. So it makes it really great for a family, as we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And you have these interactions. It's based on the European hut model, where you have interactions with other people too that you might not even know.
Social,
which, social, which adds to the whole experience in our minds. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a little bit different than the Forest Service cabins or the state. Where you would have that all to yourself. This one, you have the possibility of getting thrown in with some other people, like-minded people, of course, and it usually turns out to be a really fun time.
So how do people get there, and how difficult is it to get to in the wintertime?
Very, very easy. We're at mile 48 of the Seward Highway. There's this big turnoff. If you're heading from Anchorage, it's right before you get to Summit Lake Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it's about maybe a 3 or a half mile hike into the cabin. And basically can ski in the wintertime or snowshoe, usually a nice trail in there unless we just had fresh snow. And then the cabin has a wood-burning stove, so you get that started right away, and then you go get the yurts warmed up and start your outdoor experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went a few years ago. We rented the whole thing, the two yurts and the cabin, and we had kids. We had really young kids. We had kids of 5 years old, very easy. We had non-skiers, people were able to just walk down the trail. It's a really nice, they've done a great job with that. It went from sort of this dingy old mining cabin to a really nice facility now.
And we have like couple different options where you can just rent one yurt, or else you can also rent the whole site. If you do have a big group, which is pretty nice for like birthday parties, we've had weddings out there, you know, anniversaries, that kind of thing.
Or even do it with your neighbors. We when my kids were younger, we did that with neighbors, where we get three or four families together and you go out and have this big gang thing. All the kids are running around screaming, the parents are hanging around talking, and then everybody goes skiing to whatever their ability level is, and it's really hard to have more fun than that.
Yeah, and one of our missions is to get kids out in the wilderness, and you know, if we don't get them out when they're young, they're not going to love the wilderness like we do and want to protect it. So this is an easy way to do that, and you can just let them play and they can be outdoors all day long.
Right. So let's talk just briefly before we take a break here about reasons that or issues people might be concerned about. And I think probably the number one issue that novices are concerned about in going to the backcountry is avalanche danger. So you don't want to, obviously, if you don't have avalanche skill or knowledge, you think, well, I can't go out there at all. But to some extent, you can say, you can find out from the agency that is renting the cabins whether there is an avalanche hazard in getting to the cabin. Paul,
right.
Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think a lot of these cabins have been placed with that in mind. Not all, but many cabins, I think about Resurrection Pass, you can get in and out of them without a lot of avalanche danger. Now, that said, definitely check with the agency about potential avalanche. Check with the Huts Association. And, you know, people go, well, do I need to take a course? Yeah, the Alaska Avalanche School has courses that are of all different levels, just basic awareness courses to a lot more advanced courses. But in one respect, I tell people, well, if you want to avoid avalanches, don't get on a steep hill. Don't go out in the middle of a snowstorm or right after a snowstorm or when it's been super windy out. And so to some degree, just staying on flat terrain and out from below steep terrain will go a long way to keep you safe. And like I said, a lot of these cabins, obviously, hopefully the manager has placed the cabin out of avalanche danger, and most of them are. And many of them, even getting in and out of them, your avalanche risks are fairly low.
Yeah, and we have done a show on avalanche education and the resources for finding out if there's avalanche danger. Chugach National Forest has that avalanche center, and we've got that linked at alaskapublic.org. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. My guests today are Paul Twardock, who's chairman of the APU Outdoor Studies Department, and Paul Henrich, who's with the Alaska Huts Association. And we're talking about public use cabins in the winter. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, talk about some of the issues for preparing for your cabin trip, what you need to think about to be safe and be comfortable. But first, we're going to take a break and hear a report. Not all the cabins in our area are public use in the sense that we're talking about on today's show. The Aklutna Traverse is a popular mountaineering trip outside of Anchorage. It's also home to three huts, which are maintained by the Mountaineering Club of Alaska for use by its members. Greg Bregel tells us more about the heritage behind the three Aklutna huts. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Greg Bregel. I am currently, and for the last 10 years, the huts chairman, which means it's kind of my job to coordinate repair, maintenance, and supplying the huts. All three of those huts were built in the early to mid-60s, so 40-some years ago. Well, that's, wow, 50 now. And they were named after the person the kind of in charge and spearheaded the buildings. All the huts are off the glacier on benches up high above the glacier. The huts were extremely well built, and if you think about the number of years that they've been up there, wow, those huts take a pounding, frequently have 100 mile and plus mile an hour winds, and they didn't use all the really good building materials to put them up. It's just basically a 2x4 A-frame with 3/8 plywood on the outside and aluminum sheeting that was put on with batten strips by screws or nails, and that gets constantly picked at by the wind, and you get a small piece starts flapping, it just becomes a big piece after some time. One time we showed up to Hans's hut, and the south window had blown out during one of the various storms, probably got hit by a rock, and there was an inch and a half or two of ice in the whole hut, so we started warming it up in a little bit with the lantern and start chipping away at the floor, and had to clear that away before we can get our booties on and get a little more comfortable. And we build and maintain the huts. However, we really don't own the land. It's owned by Chugach State Park, which we really appreciate them being partners with us. The nice benefit having those huts there, if things really get ragged and the wind starts blowing, you know, tenting it under those conditions is really challenging. So, and I've been there a number of times, especially at Hans's hut when it was ripping that hard and it was challenging just to go outside for nature's call.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we're talking about winter public use cabins. Our guests today are Paul Twardock and Michael Henrich, who both have lots of experience doing this, getting out in the wintertime and skiing or snowshoeing into a cabin that doesn't belong to you, but you've rented it, and you can have an amazing outdoor wintertime experience. And it just takes a little preparation to make sure that you are comfortable and safe. And I thought we'd talk about that during this segment, about what kind of preparation to do. It's obviously, when you're out in Alaska in the wintertime, the weather can change. It can get very, very cold. You need to have what you need. Maybe if you're a mile from the trail or an on-road cabin, there's a little bit more of a safety net. But if you're going to have a fun time, you definitely need to be prepared. And if you're going a little farther afield, which I think most people would want to do after they've at least had their first experience, then you really do need to be prepared. So let's talk about some of the primary things to take along. I guess to start with warmth, right? That's what we need to think about, warming that cabin up. And you can't necessarily, or in most cases, find firewood. And in the place of the National Forest cabins, I guess they for the most part, they don't even have wood stoves anymore, right, Paul?
Right, they're using oil/kerosene stoves.
So, and you need to take the fuel. You can't count on the fuel being there.
Yep.
So what kind of fuel do you get, and how do you, where do you,
well,
do you get it?
Well, basically, you're buying a diesel number two that'll burn a stove, or you can just buy just the kerosene. Either one of those will work fine.
How much would you take along for like a weekend?
Well, I'd say a gallon a night, maybe. It depends on how cold it is and so forth, but that seems to work fairly well.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people would be intimidated about how do you get this thing to work? Is it pretty self-explanatory?
Well, yeah, they'll have instructions on there, and it's a drip system, most of them, where you get it dripping and light a little sort of primer plate, and then it'll start up. And once it starts, it works fine. So sometimes it can be a little bit finicky. This sort of leads me to tell everybody that really you have to, the cabin is there. It's great. 90% of the time, everything works out fantastic. But when you go into these places, you need to be prepared for the stove doesn't work. You need to sort of be prepared a little bit for conditions as if there was not a cabin there. Maybe someone gets injured on the way. Maybe there is maybe avalanche hazards turn you around. Maybe it gets dark and you get lost and you can't. Some of these cabins are a little hard to find, and so maybe you don't find the cabin. So I always recommend people to go prepared as if you were going to have to bivouac out. And then if you get in there and the oil stove's not working, or there's no wood, or whatever, maybe a bear broke into the cabin, and they come out of hibernation once in a while, so you never know what might come up. It's best just to have the clothes and the sleeping gear to be comfortable at night without the heat.
And I'd also add to that you have to be aware, especially if you're leading a trip and you've got kids, of where everybody is in terms of their warmth and their energy level.
Yeah.
It's really easy to think about it as if you're going home and you're walking into a warm house and everybody will just have hot chocolate and be fine. But in fact, you're going to get to a cabin that nobody's been at for a while. It's going to be freezing cold.
Yeah.
And so if you run everybody out to the end of their energy level, going into a cold cabin is not going to do them that much good. And it's going to take a while to warm it up, because you not only warm the air, but you have to warm the walls and the floor of the cabin before you actually have much warmth. In the cabin.
And a lot of times what I like to do is, if there's a group and we have some people a little bit faster than others, we sort of send them off and say, okay, go get the place warmed up, so especially with kids. And then by the time the kids show up, then the place hopefully is warmed up.
Yeah. So, Michael, you were talking about taking wood, because the state parks cabins, for the most part, don't have the diesel or the oil heaters.
Yeah. I always bring wood along with me. I mean, sometimes you go in there and there'll be a big stack of wood in there and you're happy. But I've also been there when there's not a stick of wood. And you want to make sure it's very dry wood as well. And I always chop it up into just small pieces so you can start it up. Because that, like you said, when you roll into that cabin, it's as cold as it is outdoors. So, and that can be below zero in the wintertime. And it can take, you know, upwards of at least an hour to get that fire going, and you have cold hands, and you're trying to get it going, and so it can be a little bit of a struggle. And I think you want to bring newspaper as well. I always bring along some newspaper. I remember a couple years ago, I went to the Devil's Pass cabin in the middle of winter, and that has a kerosene stove, and we couldn't get that thing going. I think we finally got it going maybe after 3-4 hours, but we were all ice cold, and everybody was bundled up, and we were fine, but it was a cold night.
And you're going to have to, I mean, when you're hiking or you're skiing or you're snowshoeing, your body's producing a lot of energy, and you're probably used to wearing fairly light stuff in town, but once you get there and you're pretty sedentary, if you're not wearing like thick down clothing and multiple layers, really good boots and thick gloves, you're going to get cold because you're sedentary and your body's not producing that.
And plus your clothing will probably be wet too, at least the underlayers.
Right.
So you pretty much got to get that off. And you always want to have at least a couple sets of clothes.
So I will tend to take along these fire starters, which are these little sort of press board pieces that are impregnated with some kind of wax or something. And so they'll start burn for quite a while. And once you get one of those going, then it's pretty easy to light the rest of your fire and pretty reliable. How much wood do you take, Michael? I mean, because it seems like that's a lot of weight.
Yeah, that's what you have to balance the weight factor with how much wood you want. It's kind of like one of those little bundles that you get for $5. You know, I always like to have probably at least a couple of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, with some smaller stuff, I've even brought along those ready-to-light logs that you put in your fireplace.
Presto logs,
Yeah, Presto logs. Yeah, those seem to work pretty well, too.
Right, yeah. And I think I've known other people who've done that. And it's that's sort of like your fire starter, but the whole thing is a fire starter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but in some cases you could find wood, but a lot of cases in the wintertime, it's really hard to find wood, especially around a cabin where the wood has been pretty much found by other people who have been there before you.
Yeah, and it's a good point to always bring a saw, too.
Mm-hmm.
You can get those real light saws, the kind of triangle ones,
mm-hmm.
and I always have one of those with me.
Yeah, that's an essential tool. What other tools would you say are essential, Paul? I mean, what things do you want to make sure? A lantern, so you can see.
Lantern or headlamps, for sure. Definitely, I would bring a headlamp and some extra batteries. Water. I mean, let's talk about water. It's not going to be, most of these places don't have open water, and winter, it all freezes. So sometimes you can find a creek to go down, and it'll be running. You can dip get a bucket and dip it. But so you want to show up with some water. You have to have water. You don't have to, but it's very helpful to have water to start if you're going to be melting snow. So you get a little water going, and then you can put your snow in going. But when you show up, the other thing I like to have is a thermos of hot water. So when I show up and people are getting in, like I said, they might be a little sweaty. They are all of a sudden they stop and they're expecting this warm cabin that's not warm. And these things are ice blocks when you show up. And it takes a while to get the stove going. It has to get a draw and it has to then thaw the ice box out. And so to have a thermos of hot water ready to go, have maybe some water bottles and insulators that are warm that you can immediately get water in. Than a stove, so
which
you want
which is not a propane stove,
right? Yeah. You get a little. Well, you can have.
I've had experience with a wintertime trip, and the
stove propane.
That my friend brought along was propane, and really wasn't cooking until we had to get the cabin completely warm before you could really get the propane to work.
Yeah, once you get down to below zero, that propane doesn't work so well. Butane's a little bit better. But a white gas stove to start up. And I'll a lot of times fire that up before I even start to get the wood stove going and get water.
Get warm drinks in people.
Yeah, get water melted.
Yeah.
And that in itself will throw out some BTU, some heat, and start touring. You got a lantern, you got a little cook stove going. All of a sudden, that'll take the chill off the air in those cabins.
And you need nice, thick, heavy sleeping bags because. But by morning, it may be, especially if you're using Michael's plan of with a wood fire, it's going to be freezing cold again.
Yeah, it certainly will cool down.
Yeah.
If you have enough wood, it's always a good idea, of course, to get up in the middle of the night, if somebody does anyway, and restock the stove. It's always kind of a battle for that first person in the morning to get out of their cold sleeping bag and get the stove going again.
I actually think that's so fun, though, you know, especially at my own place where I have an unlimited amount of wood. Is just a sort of that feeling of getting up in the morning in a chilly cabin, but and then getting it warmed up with the wood stove, and then getting the bacon on, and the kids are smelling the bacon breakfast. I mean, it's a really nice feeling.
Yeah, and if you know that, I was just thinking another nice thing for those mornings are some Dacron or down Buddhas.
Oh, those are great.
Because your boots are going to be probably damp, and you're not going to want to be clamoring. Now, if you're going lightweight, sure, you can get around with your ski boots or whatever boot you have. But boy, a pair of Dacron booties are pretty nice to be for cabin living.
Yeah, I know. I love those. Yeah, because you want to get out of your ski boots. At least I do. I mean, usually they're kind of wet and they're not the most comfortable.
For the most part, when you arrive, you probably take off all your wet stuff, especially your wet socks and underwear and put on dry stuff. It makes you feel so much better.
Yeah.
So so to carry all this stuff, we're talking about carrying a tremendous amount of stuff. You're going to have a sled. And presumably more than one sled, especially if you're carrying firewood, fuel, sleeping bags, extra coats, thermoses, stove. What kind of sled do you guys use?
I basically just constructed my own. I bought one of those little kids sleds.
Yeah, they were great. Those the plastic ones that you sit down in, right?
Yep, mm-hmm. Exactly. And had a makeshift belt attached to some PVC pipe. And that seems to work pretty good. You can also buy a fancier type of stove at REI. They're a little bit pricey, but it's not that tough to make your own.
I think those little plastic sleds are desirable because they're really lightweight. Mm-hmm. And the older style Polk sleds tended to be pretty heavy, so just the sled itself was pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And a lightweight thing works pretty good. Paul, what do you use?
Well, I've been, the older I get, the lighter I try to go. And so sometimes I don't take a sled, actually, lately. I'll, especially if the terrain has any sort of switchbacks or up a lot up and down, sometimes sleds can be a little bit of a pain. Though the sled I do have is a simple orange sled with a couple piece of climbing rope attached to it that clips into my pack. And then I have a brake rope, so it's a rope, about a 3-foot section of rope, it with knot overhand knots in it, that is attached to the front of the sled. So when I'm going downhill, I just flip that rope under the sled, and the sled then drags on that rope and slows it down, so it's not running into me all the time.
Oh, I mean, make sure people get what you're talking about, because when you're going down, say, Resurrection Trail.
Yeah.
Like say you're going Hope to Cooper Landing, it's really steep on the way down, and the sled is going to be hitting you in the back of the ankles the whole way, and it'll drive you crazy. So what you're doing is you're just creating some additional friction with the snow to slow the sled down so it doesn't
hit you. With this rope, yeah. And because like Michael was talking about the PVC pipe, sort of making a harness system, and that works great also. What I like about this system is I actually put my pack in it. My pack's in it. The pack's right side up. And so if I get to a point where let's say there's deep snow, and that's a real, a lot of work to break snow with a sled.
Yeah.
And so I can just throw that whole thing, get up on my back, the pack.
Carry the sled.
And the sled and everything. Those sleds are pretty light. If you're not going to have a setup like that, it's useful to have someone in the group without a sled. That way, if you do get a dump of snow, which is fairly common up here, someone else can be breaking trail without the sled.
And I would just add one more item, which is you really have to think about attaching your gear to the sled when you're leaving town in such a way that when it falls over, when it tumbles over, you know, you go to a switchback and it rolls down a hill, you're not going to lose your stuff. It has to be really well attached. And you're tempted when you're in town in your garage to think, oh, we could put on this, oh, stick this on, stick this on. And then you get out there. The sled keeps flipping because it's top heavy, and maybe the stuff is not attached well enough, and you start losing your stuff.
Yeah, I'd say about 40 pounds. You want 40, more, no more than about 40 pounds in a sled. I mean, after that, it gets too top heavy. So,
right, yeah. And that's a really a not very fun thing to deal
with. It's a hassle, yeah.
Well, that same trip on the Resurrection Trail that I did, my sled would come by me and go off to the side and actually go down the ravine, too.
Yeah.
And it was hooked to me, so then it would pull me off the trail, and then I'd have to haul it back up. And so, that, like Paul says, you don't want a very heavy sled if you're doing that very often.
Not fun.
And I didn't have the brake idea either going on, so which is a very good idea.
I like that idea. Yeah.
I had an experience once on the res where we had a dog, a ski jour. So the dog was pulling me, and we had one of the gals fall and hurt her knee. And pretty bad. And so we had sleds, which were great. She could sit in the sled, and we, me and the dog would pull her, right? And so we were basically evacuating her. And it wasn't a terrible, but it was better for her to be sitting in the sled than trying to walk. We got to one of these ravines and switchbacks, and I said, well, what do you want to do? You want to ride in the sled? She said, oh, I think I'll try to walk down this. And sure enough, I headed down with the dog and went down this thing, and the sled went flying off the ravine, and it was a total train wreck. And she basically walked the rest of the way. She,
yeah. Oh, I've pulled kids in a sled, and I don't think I'd go along any ravines. I'd make him get out.
Yeah, that was the case. Yeah.
But the other thing to think about is the kid is sitting there. They're pretty much not getting any exercise. They need to be wrapped up really, really, really well because they're small, and they can really get a chill. So that's another important consideration. In an upcoming show, we're going to be talking about kids in the elements, how to keep a little one warm when you're doing outdoor stuff. So stay tuned to that in the coming weeks. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about wintertime trips to public use cabins with my friends Michael Henrich and Paul Twardock. And we're going to take another break for the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. Our go-to family outdoors person is Aaron Kirkland, the author of Alaska on the Go, Exploring the 49th State with Children. It's a great book published by and she's also the publisher of the AK on the Go website, where you can get a lot of Aaron's information. I'm Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Welcome to the October edition of Outdoor Explorer's Family Calendar. I'm Erin Kirkland, publisher of akonthego.com, here with some tips and ideas for kid-friendly fun in Alaska's outdoor spaces. It's still fall in Alaska, and perhaps no other state offers such diversity in both weather and opportunity, so this is the perfect time to watch one season transition into the next. Take a hike, start a leaf collection, create a video of snow creeping down the mountains, or take one last family mountain bike ride. There's lots to do, so here are some ideas for your family. Sitka is celebrating 65 years of the Alaska Day Festival starting this weekend and running through October 19th. History meets activity in the place where Russia formally turned Alaska over to the U.S., and kids will love to see the period costumes, historical walks, and activities just for them. Visit alaskadayfestival.org for more information. Eagle River Nature Center welcomes families to a guided hike on Saturday, October 11th, along the historic Iditarod Trail. The hike is free, but do register by calling 694-2108. And don't forget, dress for the weather. Downtown Anchorage is gearing up for Trick or Treat Street and the frightening 4K costume fun run on Saturday, October 25th. Dress up in your spookiest costume and jog or walk along the streets of Anchorage before trick-or-treating with downtown merchants. Visit anchoragedowntown.org for information, a map, and registration. Friends of the Campbell Creek Science Center invites the community to their Fall Friends event on Thursday, October 23rd. And in the studio with me today is Amanda Smith, president of the organization's board of directors, here to tell us more. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Erin. Thanks for having me on.
So lots of people are familiar with Campbell Creek Science Center because their kids go on field trips there. I mean, this is like one of the outdoor experiences for kids, but that's kind of about it. I mean, a lot of people don't even know where it is or what the mission is. So why don't you tell me real quick a little bit about that?
Yeah, the BLM Campbell Creek Science Center is, the access to it is right on the corner of 64th and Elmore, so right in the heart of Anchorage. And it's 760 acres that are part of the Campbell Track, which has trails and runs right alongside the Campbell Creek. And in there is a little science center with some amazing instructors run by the BLM. And so mostly students come for field trips where outdoor education meets up with science curriculum. And it's a pretty good option for a lot of teachers to do outdoor experiential education.
So what about the Friends of Camel Creek Science Center group? Because that's not, because the Science Center itself is part of the Bureau of Land Management, correct?
Yep.
So what is the Friends of Camel Creek Science Center?
Yeah, so the Friends of the Campbell Creek Science Center is a nonprofit group of volunteers dedicated to raising funds so that every student in Anchorage who wants to come to the Science Center for a field trip can afford to. So primarily we give out scholarships, but we also support the Science Center and all that they do. And really, our mission is to inspire a sense of wonder, increase understanding of science, and promote stewardship of the environment all through the Campbell Creek Science Center.
And the Friends group has got an event coming up, which, you know, we've attended for the last several years. So tell us a little bit about what the Fall Friends event is.
Yeah, so the Fall Friends event is a really good way for folks who've never been out to the Science Center or whose children have come out, but they've never had a chance to come out between 6 and 8:30 p.m. on October 23rd, which is a Thursday evening. There's no school the next day, so that helps. And what the Fall Friends event is, it's a way to understand what the Science Center is and does, have a whole bunch of fun. We provide dinner, so there'll be soup and bread. There will be activities like design a creek critter or a macro invertebrate table so you can look at little creepy crawlies underneath a microscope. There's going to be a glacier activity. And as always, we do something outside. So there will be a night hike along Campbell Creek itself.
That's AK Kid's favorite, of course. We love to get outside with him at night at the Science Center. It's pretty exciting to put on those reflectors and go outside. So how can people find out more information about this event?
Yeah, the best way to find out information is to go to friendsofcampbellcreek.org or join our Facebook page, which will have constant updates. Or just show up. You can come to the event at 6 o'clock on October 23rd. It's a Thursday, and everyone's welcome, and it's a free event.
We like that. Thank you, Amanda. I think we're going to have to make some tracks over there next time. All right. For links to the Friends of Campbell Creek Science Center event and everything mentioned in today's family calendar, visit OutdoorExplorer.org. We'll get you connected to Alaska with your family. For Outdoor Explorer, this is Erin Kirkland of AK On The Go.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Erin Kirkland does such a great job. I'm really grateful that she puts together that family calendar for us and does the interviews. And do check out her website, AK On The Go, and her book. So today we're talking about winter public use cabins. My guests are Paul Twardock, who is the chairman of the APU Outdoor Studies Department, and Paul Henrich, who is with the Alaska Huts Association. And we talked in the first segment about why we enjoy cabins and some of the easier things for beginners to try. In the second segment, we talked a little bit about gear and preparation. Now we're going to give some information out to some of our hardcore guests. I know our listeners, I know we've got a lot of you out there who are looking to do something a bit more ambitious, a bit more exciting. And so we'll talk about some of the trips that are maybe a tiny bit more technical or challenging. Where you can go and find some great backcountry skiing and other opportunities that you might not have thought of. Michael, I know the Manitoba cabin is fabulous for backcountry skiing. That's not hardcore, but you do need to know something about backcountry skiing when you take out into that country.
Yeah, definitely. Manitoba Mountain, which is right by our Manitoba cabin or hut, has traditionally been a backcountry ski, telemark, randonnée, snowboard. Any given weekend day, there might be 30 people up there carving turns off of Manitoba.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about avalanche danger before, and Manitoba is a very safe mountain. I think like 28 degrees is its highest slope. So mm-hmm. I've never actually even seen an avalanche in 25 years of skiing. Mm-hmm. Back behind Manitoba, there's actually Silvertip Mountain, which is much more technical. And for some of your more adventurous listeners, that would be the place that they'd probably want to go.
Yeah, and so you go out to the cabin, and even though we've got short days, I mean, with short days, backcountry skiing can be somewhat more challenging because the time to get to where you're going to ski, and then you got a few runs and it starts to get dark. But if you're staying out there,
if you're staying at Manitoba, you're on the slope.
You're there.
Yeah, you're right there. And then you put your skins on right outside of the cabin, and you pretty much start climbing pretty immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get two or three runs in pretty easily on a even on the darkest winter days. And then you're skiing back to a nice warm cabin, so it doesn't really matter if it's getting kind of dark or even if it's pitch black, you can still find the cabin pretty easily.
Yeah. So, Paul, a couple of years ago, the Ski Association had put out a calendar and had this fabulous picture of a woman on the porch of the Crescent Lake cabin,
yeah,
looking up at the snow. She's, her arms are out and it's snowing and you can see her skis in the background. I guess that's a really good place to go.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two cabins up there. The one in the middle of the lake is probably the better option for skiing, backcountry skiing. The access is to the Crescent Lake, the Carter Lake trailhead. And it's probably 5 or 6 miles back in there. So it's a bit of a ski. Most of it's across the lake.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, you get in there. I went in there one spring break, and you know, the skiing was sort of rotten everywhere. And we found a fantastic, it wasn't rotten, it was a really bad avalanche cycle. And we just found a fantastic day-long run, meaning we skinned up, and then we skied down, and that was our day. And
wow.
So it's a really nice skiing back in there, for sure.
And that's a Forest Service cabin.
That's a Forest Service, yep.
Yeah.
Forest Service cabin, yep.
We talked a little bit about the Resurrection Trail, and that's about 40 miles.
Yep.
It's going to be at least a couple of days and probably 3 or 4 days to do it more relaxed.
Yep.
And you probably want to know a little bit about backcountry travel before you do it, because you could find yourself with fresh snow and not knowing where the trail is. So you need to think about navigation and all the issues we've talked about bringing your fuel and all that.
Yep. Getting over Resurrection Pass up through the Devil's Pass area, and it does have avalanche hazard,
mm-hmm,
for sure. And it's a ways in there. People have gotten stuck. If you're going to go in there, it's worth being prepared to sit out a couple days, have an extra day of food or something along with you. And, you know, I've been in there and all of a sudden had 2 feet of snow overnight. And like, oh, our nice little easy ski out to Hope is not going to be so nice and easy.
And
one's going to come rescue you. No one's going to, you know, there's not going to be anything. Now, the Res Pass alternates snow machine and non-snow machine years. I believe this year is a non-snow machine year. So given that, the skiers have to be a little more worried about having to break trail.
Mm-hmm.
And even during a on year for snow machines, they have to be concerned about, if all of a sudden you got 3 or 4 feet of snow dumped on you over a day or two, that's a significant issue even for a snow machine. So,
in any of these spots where we talk about avalanche hazard, if there's an announcement that it's a high avalanche hazard time period, you just don't go.
Well, yeah, you have to always have your avalanche radar up. I mean, anytime there's been a storm, a lot of wind, and you're in steep terrain, it doesn't have to be that steep. And, you know, 28 degrees, 30 degrees is like a beginner slope on at Alyeska. It's not that steep for it to be potentially slide. So, but obviously, when they've issued an advisory out, those are for Turnagain Pass area. And so, you know, that's a very specific area. It could be very different where you're at. And so, you know, I say, you know, be educated and then make your own decisions.
Right. I guess my point is that when you're talking about doing wintertime trips and you're pretty much self-reliant,
yeah,
You got to be prepared to cancel the trip if the conditions
really
look questionable.
Yeah. If a big wet storm has come in and a lot of wind, I tend to avoid putting myself in a position of danger to begin with. I mean, if I see something, I go, you know, that doesn't look good, I just don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it avoids the sort of anxiety and the necessity to make hard decisions. Once you've gotten yourself in a situation where you're having to make hard decisions, well, you've missed something along the way. Now, sometimes that happens. Sometimes it just happens and, you know, you don't know. The ability for the forecasters to predict snowfall is very difficult. They might say, we've all seen it here. Oh, we'll get 4 inches, and boom, we get 20 inches.
So, right. So let's talk of, everything you just said is true. On the other hand, if you've done a lot of stuff, you want to try something new, have a new adventure.
Yeah, right. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to be trying some new stuff that might be a little bit more challenging. So let's talk about some of the other sort of more adventurous trips. Do you want to throw any more in, Michael?
Well, I spend a lot of time down in Turning and Pass area, mm-hmm. and there's so many different routes that people have kind of pioneered back there these days that you can do a new one pretty much all winter long. You know,
yeah,
and there's some easy ones too, like going up Center Ridge, which is pretty safe and no real avalanche danger there. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean Alaska just has so many opportunities. You know, and it just just kind of do your research and talk to people and find out what they're doing and tag along with them. That's mm-hmm. kind of the best way to get to know places.
And if you can go up to Fairbanks, there's some mm-hmm. great cabins out there.
Yep, in the White Mountains, it's managed by the BLM, and there's a great 30 or 40 mile. You can do up to 100 mile loop. They have a 100 mile race up there every spring.
Right.
So you can do that, and those are fantastic. You know, it's north of Fairbanks, so it can be really cold. So those tend to be more spring trips. But you know, I work with a guy who is a snow machiner, and he's got a bunch of kids, and he went up there last January, and he took his kids, and he is set up. He's got his wall tents, he's got everything ready to go, and he managed it. So it's mm-hmm. doable.
Yeah, well, it's all preparation. Then we were talking, if you want to go out to Prince William Sound in the wintertime, you're almost guaranteed to have it to yourself. But there are more and more people go out there for backcountry skiing in the springtime, and the cabins, some of the cabins are probably really well situated for that.
Yeah, there are. There's one at Colross Passage. I think it's reopened that they had a mm-hmm. roof issue there. There's one in Cochrane Bay. I went to a place called Schroed Lake a few years ago for spring break.
And that's
with
a paddle in and then a climb up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. or you can charter in. We actually chartered out with a charter boat, and we then went skied in, and you know, it was classic, very experienced outdoors people that we were with, and we're like, oh, it's a 1 mile ski in. We got in there, well, the actual bay was frozen, so the guy couldn't get his boat in.
Oh,
so
wow.
What turned out to what we expected, a little 15 minute ski, ended up being 2 hours.
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
a classic example. You just have to be prepared for that. But we showed up at the cabin, and we'd been warned that the cabin could be buried. Right, literally, all you would see was the tip of the cabin if you saw that. Now, in our case, we found it; it was fine, but the door was, frozen shut and drifted in. So another hour, 2 hours was spent digging that out.
Yeah.
So you just sort of have to be prepared for the unexpected.
Yep.
Yeah. A shovel.
Yeah.
Talk about tools. A shovel, super important.
Yeah. And then if you wanted to do any of those trips, I mean, if you go out to Cordova. In the Copper River area, you're not going to find any other people, and they're glorious places out there to visit.
Yeah, fantastic.
Lots of trails and lots of good skiing out there and stuff to do winter and summer. I mean, it's all a matter of the weather, of course, whether it's nice.
I'll put a plug in also for the Bomber Traverse. It's the Mountaineering Club of Alaska. That's a very technical route, but a great area for skiing up in the Talkeetna Mountains. But you really got to know your avalanche and route finding, and it's somewhat technical skiing getting in and out of those huts. So
So if you're wondering about more information, you'll find it at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show, Winter Cabins, and the links there go to the reservation systems, and the reservation systems have maps, and you can click on the cabins and get more information. You call rangers, get the real lowdown, so when you plan your trip, you're being safe and you're being sensible and you're having the actual on-the-scene data. The kind of stuff we've been getting from my two great guests. Paul Twardock, who you just heard from, is the chairman of the Outdoors Studies Department at APU. And Paul Henrich is with the Alaska Huts Association. Thanks, both gentlemen.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so next week, we're going to be talking about ski swaps, getting used equipment. When should you get used? When should you get new? What do you look for? How do you go to a ski swap successfully? Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.